This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When I worked at Marketplace, the national business show, in the early 2000s, it seemed like we ran a hand-wringing story about the housing bubble every week. How big was it going to get? When was it going to burst? And perhaps a little greedily, was it still a good time to buy and flip a home? Well, we all saw what happened when the bubble finally did burst. By 2010, nearly a quarter of all U.S. mortgage holders were underwater, owing more on their homes than the properties were worth. The precipitous housing decline helped drive the country into recession and keep it there. But we're out of recession now, officially anyway, and the housing market has been picking up steam. In fact, nationally, there's a problem in some places with too few houses on the market rather than too many. So today on the show, we're going to look at the real estate market here in Vermont and how it compares to national trends. We abide by the common saying that the highs are never as high in Vermont as they are in other places and the lows never as low. So let's see where things actually do stand with home buying and selling. And is there a market difference from county to county within the state? Listeners, if you are buying or selling a home this summer, give us a call and tell us what the picture looks like from your point of view. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Is the dream of owning a home tarnished for you or still just as strong? You can also post your thoughts at vpr.net. And we're joined today by Phil Dodd, editor and publisher of the Vermont Property Owners Report. Phil, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
And by Claire Wallace, president of Vermont Realtors. That's the professional association for real estate agents in Vermont. And Claire also co-owns Wallace Realty in Bristol. Claire, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much, Jane, for having me.
Phil Dodd, let's start with you. Can you give us a better sense here of what the national picture looks like? I mean, you're reading things now, or I'm reading things at least, in the papers that are in some ways so confusing. You know, Las Vegas, super hot, then super not hot, and now super hot again, and yet perhaps still undervalued. I mean, just give us the big picture here of what the heck we're seeing in the housing market.
Well, it is a very different picture nationally than in Vermont. There was a much bigger downturn in values after that housing bubble burst in places like California, Arizona, Nevada, Florida. And at some point, a number of factors started to boost those markets in the particularly depressed areas, partially because the values had gotten so low. Large companies came in and started buying up homes to rent out. They saw this as a long-term investment. And so Wall Street money started turning up. I think I read recently that flippers are back in California. And so those prices have been rising quickly, but they're still not back to where they were.
Well, back to where they were when perhaps they were overvalued, or back to where they were when there's some consensus that home prices were reasonable?
I was referring to where they were, which probably was overvalued.
So would you say nationally housing prices have stabilized? I mean, are we in the midst of something?
Well, they're still going up. I think the National Association of Realtors reported recently that the median sale price was up 15% over the last year. So the prices are rising. There is a lot of activity. I think there may be starting to be a shortage of properties for sale in a lot of these areas, which then has the effect of pushing up prices even more. So I'm not sure we're done seeing the national numbers rise.
And what about Vermont? Housing prices not up 15% in
Vermont. No, it's not. According to the statistics I just looked at, they're up about the single family primary home up about 2.3% median price in the last year. We never had the big downturn. We didn't have the bubble. We didn't have the subprime lending that really drove the rest of the country created such a mess in the end. So prices, you know, may have slipped and values may have slipped a bit, but not much. We are now seeing, you know, rising volume, more sales, and in a few places, Chittenden County in particular, the inventory dropping. So that is appears to be flipping over to a seller's market in Chittenden County.
Claire Wallace, does all of that jive with what you are actually seeing on the ground as a realtor in the Champlain Valley?
Yes, it does, absolutely. I think our biggest concern right now is the imbalance between our strong demand and the constrained supply of our inventory, which has dropped about 5.3%. And we have statistics available that are posted monthly now on the Vermont Realtors website, which is vermontrealtors.com, and it's a monthly market report. May is there now. We expect June to be posted within the next couple of days, but it supports most everything that Phil was discussing. And just like around the country, there's variations in these statistics. The same with Vermont. It's not the same in Chittenden County as you might see in other areas where the growth of the sales have been a little bit more sluggish, and particularly the condo market has not kept up with the residential market.
So when you say one of the things that you're seeing is not enough houses for the people who actually want to buy them, is that constrained to Chittenden County or is that statewide?
That's pretty much statewide where we've seen the inventory. And it's a monthly supply that we're looking at where you can do the math and come up with what you need for the next 12 months to meet the demand. And you do that by just looking at how many sales on average we have each month and divide into the inventory. And we have seen a decrease in every single county on the monthly supply from as much as Chittenden County, which the sales have been the most robust, have dropped by 40.9% on monthly supply. And as small as in Windsor County, it's about 4.4%. So again, there's quite a variation. And that has to do also with particular price ranges. That won't be the same if you're in the very high price range. There's fewer buyers. But where the buyers are in the $200,000 to $350,000 range, we're seeing a decrease in availability.
Decrease in availability, but is there an accompanying increase in interest, or is it just that people are holding off on selling?
Increase in interest and not enough new listings matching that. We were pretty balanced, and in fact, for a while we had more housing than we had the buyers. The buyers are active. The interest rates are very favorable in spite of this blip, slight blip that went up. When you're looking at 5% or a little below in some banks, it has big dramatic impact on that monthly payment. So we need to keep that money flowing. We need to keep the buyers active, but we need inventory to give them choices.
Phil Dodd, I brought out that trope that, you know, the highs are never as high, the lows are never as low in Vermont. Let's bring out another one. Chittenden County, different from the rest of the state in terms of housing, is it?
Absolutely. Looking at 2012 and the sales in that month, the median single-family home price in Chittenden County was $275,000. In the statewide average was $205,000. So,
which is a significant difference.
Significant difference. The next highest county was Lamoille County at $230,000. So that's $45,000 less than Chittenden County. I mean, let's face it, Chittenden County is where the jobs are. A greater percentage of jobs are turning up in Chittenden County, and people who want to live closer or want to live there. And so I think and when you look at these statistics of how fast properties turn over and what Claire was talking about in terms of inventory, things just move a lot faster in Chittenden County. They have the realtors keep a figure called days on the market, and it's lower there.
Claire, do you find that when you're selling houses in Chittenden County versus Addison County over near where you live and where you work in Bristol?
Definitely. I sell in Chittenden County and Addison County, and recently have had experience where there were multiple bids on properties, and by the time I would call on a new listing to even get the appointment, there were already offers coming in. So we're seeing a 30 to 60 day potential for a house to be listed with the multiple listing service and then having an offer come in. And then it's another average of about 6 weeks to get to a closing. And if you look at the days on market, we're down about 1%. And so we're dropping where we had houses that were 6 months, as much as 3 years on the market during the recession. So it's encouraging. Buyers have to go more quickly. They have to be able to make their decisions faster than they did before. They don't have the luxury of time. And Addison County, we're also now beginning to see multiple bids with sometimes offers higher than the asking price, which we hadn't seen in about 6-7 years. So it's very encouraging, but the strategy for buyers and sellers have to be realistic. They have to follow these trends and, again, contact their local realtors and have a chat, find out what's going on so that they can place themselves correctly in the market.
We're talking today about Vermont's housing market. We've been hearing a lot of news swirling around about the national housing market and improvements, and we wanted to see where Vermont fits into that picture. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you as well. If you are looking at homes, thinking about maybe this is the right time to buy, watching those interest rates tick up and thinking, okay, I better jump in now before they get any higher. Or maybe you've been waiting to sell your home until things looked a little bit better for sellers. What are you seeing? What's happening in your neighborhood? Are you driving around seeing a lot of for sale signs, and are they going up or coming down? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Chris on our Facebook page who says, "We just bought a house in New York. We wanted to stay in Vermont, but house prices are double to triple what they are just over the bridge in New York. And since our work allows us to travel back to Vermont each day, it worked out. We found nothing we were willing to live in for the not small amount of money we had to spend. I wish it were different," Chris says, "but we are very happy with our new home in Port Henry." Phil Dodd, are surrounding regions, surrounding states having lower home prices or more for what you can afford?
You know, I think it depends so much on the town you're looking at and the region you're looking at. There are differences, you know, when you look at states as a whole. And actually, over the last few years, Vermont prices have done a little better than some of the other states like New Hampshire and Maine. So, you know, for better or worse, maybe our economy held up a little better and maybe people didn't overbuy during the boom. And so the market here has been a little more stable. But certainly buyers can shop around if the prices are too high in Chittenden County, the farther you go out, the lower you'll find the prices in general.
We got a note from Fred who says, "Alarm bells ring whenever I hear the phrase an improving housing market. The sooner we learn that home price inflation is an unmitigated disaster for our society, the better off we will be. When stocks collapse, it is, after all, only paper. When house prices collapse, households, neighborhoods, and communities are thrown into turmoil for years." Claire Wallace, I'm curious about that comment and how you, as a realtor, whether or not you've adjusted what you say to potential buyers and to potential sellers, given what we've seen over the last 6 years or so.
This is a good question because the answer is what I like to hear for my own investment and my own property, and I think it's something that the buyers need to understand. This is an investment, and actually an investment in a home in Vermont during this recession was one of the safest investments they could have. It might not have afforded them a quick turnover to be able to be mobile and leave, but they didn't lose their equity in that property. We had very few of the junk mortgages, so we don't have very many foreclosures, which have a dramatic effect when you're doing a market analysis or an appraisal for a sale. So we didn't have those distressed properties bringing down our value. So a buyer that bought and held tight and hunkered down like we do had that equity left. And that's the same in talking about going to New York State and even some pockets of Vermont that people say, well, the prices are so much cheaper. But if you look at the history, the person in that neighborhood didn't build the equity that they might if they were in a more robust community, and particularly Chittenden County, Addison County, and the closer to the urban area and the airport and the amenities that are there, we're seeing the investment being very sound and secure. So people need to think about, are they going to stay in that house forever, or are they hoping to build some equity and have some leverage when they do decide to move?
Jane,
yeah,
I just wanted to address that that comment from one of your listeners. You know, it is we did go through a very scary time, and there was a real unusual situation where Wall Street was packaging these subprime mortgages and selling them like hotcakes, and nobody really understood what was in them. And it really, you know, that's our recession. The Great Recession was caused by this. And so it does make one pause a little bit when you see a 15% raise. Now, this is not, I'm not talking about Vermont. I'm talking about nationally. And, you know, even the realtors, this was an interesting comment from their chief economist on June 20th.
Chief economist for the National Realtors Association?
Correct. He said, the home price growth is too fast, and only additional supply from new home building can moderate future price growth. So there's, you know, there is some concern that in these states that are seeing these booms that it's, you know, it's going to be up and then is it going to be down? I think Vermont's been a lot better off. I have heard that there are people still who maybe bought at the peak with a big mortgage and they can't quite unload yet. They still need to see prices firm up a bit. And interestingly, I did look at the foreclosure numbers for this year, and through May, they're up 27% in Vermont. So that story's not entirely over either.
Do you think that's due to a backlog in getting these foreclosures processed?
I suspect so. You're probably aware there was this robo-signing scandal and everything slowed down for a bit. So that's coming back. But and our foreclosure situation didn't compare anywhere close to these other states that are now seeing prices bounce back. And but I share your listeners' concern about, you know, the volatility in some places, not here.
Well, and nonetheless, even if we didn't experience the same rate of foreclosure as other states, the fact that it is still climbing in Vermont, as you said, means the story isn't over for a lot of households and
for
families.
Those people who were hit by it, it's a tragedy.
We're talking today about the real estate market in Vermont. We're looking at all of the trends swirling around here, how they compare to the national market. We're going to talk a little bit as well about lending. Are we seeing more lending? What's going on with the banks? And Claire Wallace, our realtor on the scene here, can tell us what she's seeing from the people that she's working with. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you as well. Tell us what's happening in your neighborhood, what you're seeing in terms of market value, what you're seeing in terms of sales, if you're maybe thinking about sticking your toe in the water. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're exploring how Vermont fits into the national trend of an improving housing market. We're talking with Phil Dodd, editor and publisher of the Vermont Property Owners Report, and Claire Wallace, president of Vermont Realtors, the state's professional association. And we're hearing from some of you as well. If you have real estate questions, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's again 1-800-639-2211, or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Mark writes in to remind us that increased prices for homes can be a double-edged sword when it comes time to assess local property taxes. Mark says, as housing prices creep up, those sales are recorded in the city and town assessor's office and will be factored into the next periodic assessment. Higher prices paid for homes equate to higher property taxes for everyone come August. And let's go to Patty, who's calling in from Hinesburg. Hey, Patty, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We're working with a wonderful realtor, live in Chittenden County, and have our house on the market. It's been on the market for over a month and a half, and we've shown it three times, which doesn't seem like a lot to us, although when we haven't actually checked in with our realtor yet about that. We have an appointment with her this week. But we wondered if there was, I know that there are fewer people looking for properties that have more acreage and are in the higher price range, but I wondered if how do you know if the price you've chosen in the range is appropriate given how many people are looking? Is this how many people are looking for higher priced range houses right now in Chittenden County?
Patty, thanks very much for the call. Claire Wallace, let's go to you first on Patty's questions.
Well, it would be hard to, not knowing the buyers and that they haven't identified themselves until they actually make an offer. So there's a lot of activity out there. Certainly, the higher priced we get, and particularly a middle price. Sometimes if you're over $1 million or you're up to $2 million, there might be even a few more buyers. They're looking to move cash into real estate and out of an investment that they might not be happy with. And then we have the 500,000-600,000 range. Sometimes they're a little harder. But I see on our, we get daily notices of properties that have come on the market, properties that have gone under contract, and we still see a pretty good balance through the price range, but and it only takes one buyer. So sometimes you could go, and then you might have a day that three people will show up, and they all want the same house. It is a very unpredictable process because there's so many working parts, so many realtors, and so many buyers, not all working with just one company. So until it becomes a statistic, which means that it's under a contract, it's hard, it would be hard to predict. But you do need to look at how you're priced. You do have a tax assessment that your town gives you. You can check on the common level of appraisal through the state and show where are you with real values. Are you at 80%? Are you at 90%, 100%? That tells you whether you're tax assessment by the town is where you, if it's at 100%, that should be a price that you should be looking at to market your property. And certainly consider price reductions. You know what your debt is. You have to figure that into what you can afford to take for the offer. And so the math needs to be done by the homeowner. But it's a lot of it location and price. That it seems like those are overused phrases, but it's the truth. And so you just need to look at that, how you're marketing it, how accessible it is. Do you have restrictions on showings? That can affect it. So again, have a good conversation with your realtor. They should be able to guide you and show you recent sales. We have wonderful programs through our MLS that will show all the recent sales, including any foreclosed properties that might have an impact on your neighborhood. It's called RealList, and we have that as a link on our MLS, and it's on your listing. You can do it on your own listing at the top of the page. So contact your realtor, and they'll be able to explain that, and you'll see how you fit within the marketplace in your neighborhood.
Phil Dodd?
Yes, that's all good advice. A couple other ideas. You can always hire an appraiser who will give you their opinion on the value. It's also true that all sales are recorded on transfer tax returns, which are available at your local town office, and you can go look and see what sold recently. In terms of the high-end market, I have heard that there is more interest statewide. I mean, particularly in southern Vermont, a lot of high-end properties just have been sitting there, and now things are moving a little bit. I think in a lot of cases the prices have come down, and that's what's kicking the action off. I mean, I think some of these high-end places may have dropped 25% in some of the resort areas. We recently had a high-end sale in Colchester, $3.8 million for lakefront property in Colchester. The interesting part to me was the town had assessed the property at $6.25 million. So the property actually went for a third less than the town had assessed it. But that's probably an unusual case, but some of these high-end properties probably are lower than this town assessment.
We got a note from Carrie who says, "We just bought a great house in Brandon. We love the area and the community, and we're super excited to be a part of the community." We got a note from Mark who says, "How do the ups and downs of the real estate market in Vermont affect the market for renters looking to lease an apartment or condo?" "It's my informal understanding," Mark says, "that rents seldom decrease even as home prices decrease, but rents do increase as home prices increase." Now, Claire or Phil, I don't know if either one of you follows the rental market, but what are we seeing in terms of the rental market as the Vermont housing market for buying and selling strengthens? Phil, do you see it? Do you have any
sense of that? Well, I don't track that as closely. I think the listener may be correct. I mean, when the market was declining, there probably were more people looking to get into apartments, and so that put some demand there. Perhaps now with more buying going on, that'll ease a little pressure on the rental side, but I can't tell you exactly which way rents are going now.
Let's go to Bob, who's calling in from Wells River while we're on this topic. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Well, you just answered my question. I was going to see what the connection was between rents and home prices. So I'd like to switch gears then and ask if you know, how the banks, you know, is money getting any easier to access here in Vermont?
Yeah, Bob, thanks for the question. Claire Wallace, what are you seeing?
Well, I will say during the recession, the FHA product was one of the only places that we could actually take a buyer and they could get a reasonable loan. The local banks became far, they raised the bar, basically. So your credit score and your percent down was much greater than in 2005, 6, 7. And so that really made it difficult for even a good buyer to get a loan. So, again, the FHA product was very strong. They were very active, and that was for quite a few years some of the only loans that we were seeing written. Now our local banks have completely turned around. They still have pretty high credit scores that they're looking for, but we're seeing them accept 10% down. There are still some banks that you can get 5% down. There's first-time homeowner programs that actually have grants available. There's a lot of information, again, just even on the MLS sheet itself that will guide you to finding programs for down payment resources. And, again, your local realtor has that information for the first-time buyers. But it's much more encouraging than it was for quite a few years. So land is even at that particular area where it was very hard to get a loan, a mortgage for purchasing of land for new construction. That also has turned around. So it's quite encouraging.
So you are seeing people being able to buy land when they weren't in the past.
That's correct.
Phil Dodd?
Just a comment on financing. We're at a very interesting point in terms of interest rates right now. Back in April, the 30-year fixed mortgage was around 3.5, and by the end of June, it had jumped a point to 4.5. So that makes a big difference in how much people can afford for a house, and it's going to be key to the future of the market, which direction these rates go or if they stay stable. I did happen to see a housing survey done by Fannie Mae recently. And the increasing mortgage rates were affecting people. They polled people and found 57% expected them to jump in the next 12 months. They also expected housing prices to keep rising. 72% said it was a good time to buy, and 36% said it was a good time to sell. But as we watch this market here, the interest rates are playing a big role. And of course, this all comes back to the Federal Reserve and this giant experiment we're going through right now. Back in September, they said, we're going to buy $40 billion worth of mortgage bonds every month and additional purchases to drive these interest rates down. But now they're talking about edging away from that. And so it's a big unknown. In the short term, I think buyers are going to be motivated to maybe get a mortgage sooner than later because of the potential of the rising rates.
Well, Claire Wallace, I'm curious if that even is affecting the sellers, people who maybe were trying to wait, see if they could get a better price for their home, but are also looking to, to sell and then to buy again. And are they impacted by these slightly rising mortgage rates?
I think in a real sense, they understand that it's still a good rate. So what's happening and will happen is that they may have to drop down their expectations. So instead of looking at a $350,000 house, they may be looking at a $330,000 house because the purchasing ability is going to diminish based on that interest rate. And coupled with that, it's our taxes. So we really, really have to follow what's going on in Montpelier related to our property tax and the school tax that is right. It's burdening our sales greatly because even if a person is sensitized, when they go to purchase that house, the bank looks at the full tax amount, not the fact that they're not going to pay that amount, that they might get half of that back. They have to look at the full amount. And so that monthly amount put with the mortgage amount will bring down the level or the price point of how they're looking. So I don't think it's going to stop the activity as much as they are going to have to look back and reflect on what can they really afford now with that maybe $100 more a month that they might have to pay based on an interest increase. But I will say there are some banks that still have some reasonable interest rates, and we're going to see people buying points, which will bring the rate down. We didn't see that for a long time. There were 0 points, which is 1% of the loan amount. And we're going to...
Meaning, let me just stop you there, just for people who maybe haven't bought a house or aren't familiar with that. You pay more up front to get a lower interest rate,
that's
basically.
Correct. You're buying down that interest rate. And that might be $1,000, $2,000 at the beginning of the mortgage. And in some cases, when you close, you can get a credit for that. So negotiate with your banks. Shop around with your bank. Shop around with your mortgage companies. It's not apples to apples. And there are some very good programs that are available. So one needs to just do their homework and have a conversation with the banks until they find the one that matches what their needs are.
Wanted to confirm the concern about property taxes. I live in Montpelier, and the school tax is going up 9.4%. If it keeps going at this rate, our school taxes are going to double in a little over 7 years.
Going up to 9.4%?
They're increasing by 9.4%, and that means they'll double in a little over 7 years at this if the rate continues. And so I think it is important. And the legislature has started looking at what they might do on the property tax side.
Yeah, Claire?
Yeah, if I could jump in on that, this is very exciting news because we've just received it in June. But Vermont Realtors applied to the National Association of Realtors for an issues mobilization grant, and we were given $50,000, which is phase one. We are ultimately hoping to get as much as $150,000 to even $200,000. And we have hired Art Wolf and his company with Richard Heaps, and they have the Northern Economic Consultants, and we also have hired Oliver Olson, who was a former representative. And by October, we will have they will have done their research, bringing us all the statistics on the funding and as it relates to education funding, how it relates to Vermont property taxes. They'll analyze Vermont's education spending and also the tax system that funds education. And we'll be looking at options to reduce spending in the property taxes. We will then be actually working with legislators to create bills. We will be testifying. We will share this data that will be homespun. We're not high, it's not an out-of-state company. These are local economists that will be helping us. So they're more tuned into our reality in Vermont.
I suppose, and no surprise, though, Claire, that a realtors association would want to see lower property taxes, would be concerned about this. You know, we just have a second left, but I want to ask you one sort of side question that isn't directly about houses, but about your own industry. One of the casualties of the flailing housing market was certainly a loss of income for realtors. And I think that the statistics are something like 1,000 realtors left the profession in Vermont during the housing crash. Any coming back?
That's correct. Yes, they are. And we have classes that are for new licensees that are very active. We've jumped from our budgeted amount of 1,015 members, we're up to 1,600 members. So it went from 1,515 to over 1,600. So we are growing back, but we're not up to over 2,000, 2,500 where we were 7-8 years ago. And I don't expect that we will get to that level again. But people still need a realtor to open that door, get in the property. We are rural in Vermont. It cannot all be done by computer. Real people have to be part of this process, and so realtors do have a role.
Although people can sell their homes on their own, we should point out. But
that's correct.
You know, this is fascinating. We're still going to keep an eye on the housing market, see where it goes in Vermont, watch the twists and turns, even if they're slightly smaller twists and turns than we see in the rest of the country. Claire Wallace is president of Vermont Realtors. That's the professional association for real estate agents in Vermont, and she co-owns Wallace Realty in Bristol. Phil Dodd is the editor and publisher of the Vermont Property Owners Report. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Coming up, we're going to talk with Congressman Peter Welch about legislative priorities for the House of Representatives after this Independence Day recess that they just returned from. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Congress returned to Washington after the Independence Day break to a lot of big-ticket items. Immigration reform promises to be contentious in the House, and there is still the Farm Bill and student loans, among many other things to deal with. Congressman Peter Welch joins us now to talk about what he's going to take the fight to in the next month or two. He's back in Washington, D.C. Congressman, nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
So on July 1st, interest rates on student loans more than doubled. That's been in the news a lot. They're up to 6.8%. And that's basically because Senate Democrats were unable to come to an agreement. The bill that passed in the House would have pegged interest rates to the U.S. Treasury borrowing cost plus 2.5%. I know that's a lot of numbers. But basically, right now, U.S. borrowing rates are extremely low. They could certainly go way up. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office projected that rates on Stafford loans would rise to 5% next year, 7.7% in 2023. You voted no on that bill, but what do you think would work?
We should extend the current low rates of 3.4%. There's really no justification for us not to do that. And I'll tell you why. Even as interest rates have come up a bit, the government borrows at about 2.5%, 2.6%. Why are we going to make middle-class families and kids pay 6.8% essentially to use that money for other things as opposed to education? And this challenge that our families are having, the parents and the kids, affording education is my view, a crisis. And it's a combination of tuitions that have increased well beyond inflation, wages, or profits. We just can't keep up. It's not sustainable. And a reduction in federal aid. This Stafford Loan Program, keep in mind, was in the halcyon days of Congress when R. Bob Stafford, a Republican, worked with Senator Claiborne Pell, a Democrat, and they passed the Pell Grants and the Stafford Loans. So the right thing for Congress would be to extend the current interest rates at 3.4%. This is brutal on our kids and on our families.
But what do you think is likely to happen? I mean, that wouldn't have passed the House. It didn't pass the Senate. Interest rates have risen. And I should point out that that interest rate increase doesn't affect students who have the loans. It's going to affect students who are signing loans, you know, as they enter college this fall, for example. But
well, the problem with student loans is really an indication of the larger dysfunction in Congress. I mean, Congress should fundamentally be about addressing practical problems in practical ways. We have a big debate in this country and in Congress about the level of spending and about the level of taxes. And those are debates that always are going to occur and should. But at the end of the day, compromise has to be seen as constructive. And the ideological division that we have in Congress is getting in the way of coming to practical compromise. And the fact that we didn't we've let the student loan rates increase, that's actually quite disgraceful. The fact that we haven't passed a farm bill is just unacceptable, and it's an indication of congressional dysfunction. You know, we've got this sequester that's been in place. It's something I opposed as this across-the-board sort of mindless approach to things that somebody like the former Governor Dick Snelling would never have done. But 100% of the members of Congress say they were opposed to the sequester, yet it went into effect. And that tells you that the institution itself is really dysfunctional. And that's a challenge.
So what do we do? Wait till the next elections?
Well, there's two things. I mean, number one, what I'm trying to do is work with Republicans to define what are concrete things where we can work together and make progress. Like, for instance, on energy efficiency. I've worked with a lot of Republicans, and we're actually making some significant progress, and I think are going to have something to show for that. On the National Security Administration and FISA, I'm working with some Republicans in an effort to try to restore some privacy rights to American citizens. So there's a number of people here in Congress, both on the Republican and Democratic side, who want to focus on where we agree and make progress in it.
But what about the places that you don't agree then? Things like immigration reform, the farm bill, things that are stalling in one chamber or the other or are unlikely to be reconciled between the two. I mean, if there's no agreement on big things like that, what are we supposed to do about those issues?
The fact that Congress doesn't make decisions on things like the farm bill and on the sequester means that America is in stall speed, and ultimately it threatens progress. It's very bad. What we should be doing here in Washington is having public policies that help people back home be successful in their efforts. You know, at the end of the day, American voters are going to have to sort things out. But we've created some obstacles here that are making it very difficult even for people who want to make progress on both sides of the aisle. If you have these gerrymandered districts where you're rewarded for not compromising at all, and you're just an impacted incumbent because of a specially designed boutique district, that's very bad. The influence of money in politics has made it much more difficult. The proliferation of outside groups that weigh in very aggressively if a member of Congress, particularly on the Republican side, indicates any willingness to compromise, that's a challenge as well. So, you know, what I'm seeing is that a lot of tremendous leadership is coming out of the states and even some of our municipalities. And what I see is the challenge for those of us who serve in Congress is to make the effort to get us back to problem solving. And that means just hanging in, finding the places where we can make progress and doing everything possible to work together and change the culture here.
Well, let me ask you about one issue where I'm curious if you think that's possible. On the farm bill, the farm bill failed to pass in the House last month, and now some House Republicans are calling for it to be split into two parts. And this is not a new call. We've heard this before. But one part would cover agriculture, and another part would cover hunger and food aid, which is a huge part of the farm bill budget. Do you think that you could gain more traction on each of those pieces if you separated them?
No, I actually think we'd get less traction on each of them. The farm bill has always been a very complicated piece of legislation involving nutrition. That's the food stamps, but also conservation, environmental issues, and farm support programs.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, it has taken a bipartisan coalition and a rural and urban coalition to put it together to come up with an acceptable compromise.
Right.
What happened here was not that we didn't have an ability to pass a bill, but the leadership did something that I've just never seen when leadership is intent on getting a bill passed. You know, the speaker is a parted company with the chair of the Agriculture Committee and made it a personal effort to bring down the dairy provision. And that was very important in Vermont, but it was a very essential component in the passage of the Farm Bill in the Agriculture Committee. And I've never seen that done before. Then secondly, the majority leader came on the floor and was the promoter of an amendment that was really quite toxic on the food stamp program and was guaranteed to cost votes rather than get votes for the ultimate passage of the bill. So you can't pass tough legislation if you have the speaker and the chair of a committee working across purposes, or you have the majority leader basically advocating for what I would call a very extreme amendment that clearly was going to bring votes down. So that's part of the dilemma here, because it is tough to pass legislation. And people are looking with dismay at the way Congress fails to make decisions. In my view, we've got to be much more disciplined on being focused on the task at hand, not having members put incidental and extraneous amendments on legislation that really may serve their own partisan or their own personal political views, but get in the way of doing what is necessary for the good of the country.
Congressman Welch, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I want to move quickly on this topic so we can get to your legislation on Syria and military intervention. On the immigration reform bill, give me an honest assessment here. Should people just assume that it's not going to happen in this legislative session, or at least not before you leave for your August recess?
Well, it won't happen before the August recess, but I remain somewhat optimistic that we will pass immigration reform.
Somewhat optimistic does not fill me with hope.
Well, you are right to be apprehensive given the institution of the House. But here's the bottom line. The Senate passed a very good immigration reform bill by a solid bipartisan vote. America needs it. And it's a balanced approach that we can take. The House and Mr. Boehner is having a real challenge on this because there's some folks there who just won't take yes for an answer. But if we can pass a bill and get into conference, I think the politics and the substance can get us across the finish line. The substance is America needs comprehensive immigration reform. It's important for that we secure our borders. This bill would do it. It's important that we have access to the labor force that our farmers and some of our resort communities need. And it's essential for that we have a path to citizenship, and the bill accomplishes all of those things. The Republicans that are having a hard time with this are caught in a bind where some of the folks in the gerrymandered districts can just say no. But many of the Republicans know that for their party's future, they have to say yes. So Mr. Boehner's got to wrestle with that. But in the end of the day, it's going to be good for them, and it's going to be good for America.
All right. I want to give you 30 seconds here. I'm sorry that's all we have left in the whole show, but 30 seconds to talk about your bill to block U.S. military intervention in Syria without congressional approval. Why is that necessary?
Congress has been too passive as a bystander when it comes to America's getting into wars. And if we're going to take military action, then Congress should be involved in that discussion and that debate. That's number one. And that's what my legislation with Rand Paul would require us to do. But secondly, let's learn the lessons from Iraq and Afghanistan. Should we Americanize the civil war? You know, I was in a Syrian refugee camp in Turkey, and your heart breaks when you're there. I mean, there is enormous suffering in that country. And in the refugee camp, I met mothers who did not know where their sons or husbands were. They had children who had been badly injured and burned. Every impulse in you wants to help. But that you want to help doesn't mean that you can. And where you have this very complicated civil war, where grievances go back decades,
yeah.
Sunni and Shia, it's not something that lends itself to a quick and easy solution.
Well, we're going to have to continue to watch what happens. Again, Congressman Peter Welch's bipartisan bill introduced would require congressional approval for military aid to Syria. It does not affect humanitarian aid. Congressman, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. That's it for Vermont Edition. We're going to talk about the situation with homelessness in Vermont tomorrow. Big changes afoot. Be sure to listen into that discussion. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.